Chapter 2. The ex-plumber, Supreme Good Member Arnie Cott of the Waterworkers Local, 4th Planet Branch, rose from his bed at 10 in the morning and, as was his custom, strolled directly to the steam bath. "Hello, Gus."
"Hi there, Arnie."
Everybody called him by his first name, and that was good. Arnie Cott nodded to Bill and Eddie and Tom, and they all greeted him. The air, full of steam, condensed around his feet and drained off across the tiles to be voided. That was a touch which pleased him. The baths had been constructed so as not to preserve the runoff. The water drained out onto the hot sand and disappeared forever. Who else could do that? He thought, let's see if those rich Jews up in New Israel have a steam bath that wastes water. Placing himself under a shower, Arnie Cott said to the fellows around him, "I heard some rumor I want checked on as soon as possible. You know that combine from California, those Portuguese that originally held title on the FDR mountain range, and they tried to extract iron ore there, but it was too low grade and the cost was way out of line? I heard they sold their holdings."
"Yeah, I heard that too," all the boys nodded. "I wonder how much they lost. Must have taken a terrible beating."
Arnie said, "No, I heard they found a buyer that was willing to put up more than they paid. They made a profit after all these yars. So it paid them to hold out. I wonder who's nuts enough to want that land. I got some mineral rights there, you know. I want you to check into who bought that land and what kind of operation they represent. I want to know what they're doing over there."
"Good to know those things."
Again, everyone nodded, and one man, Fred, it looked like, detached himself from his shower and padded off to dress.
"I'll check into that, Arnie," Fred said over his shoulder. "I'll get to it right away."
Addressing himself to the remaining men, Arnie soaped himself all over and said, "You know, I gotta protect my mineral rights. I can't have some smoozer coming in here from Earth and making those mountains into, like, for instance, a national park for picnickers. I'll tell you what I heard. I know that a bunch of communist officials from Russia and Hungary, big boys, was over here around a week ago, no doubt looking around. You think because that collective of theirs failed last year they gave up? No. They got the brains of bugs. And like bugs, they always come back. Those Reds are aching to establish a successful collective on Mars. It's practically a wet dream of theirs back home. I wouldn't be surprised if we find out that those Portuguese from California sold to communists, and pretty soon we're seeing the name changed from the FDR Mountains, which is right and proper, to something like the Joe Stalin Mountains." The men all laughed appreciatively. "Now, I got a lot of business ahead of me today to conduct," Arnie said, washing the soap suds from him with furious streams of hot water. "So I can't devote myself to this matter any further. I'm relying on you to dig into it. For example, I've been traveling east where we got that melon experiment in progress, and it seems like we're about to be entirely successful in inducing the New England type of melon into growing here in this environment. I know you all have been wondering about that because everybody likes a good slice of cantaloupe in the morning for his breakfast, if it's at all possible."
"That's true, Arnie," the boys agreed.
"But," Arnie said, "I got more on my mind than melons. We had one of those UN boys visiting us the other day protesting our regulations concerning the niggers. Or maybe I shouldn't say that. Maybe I should talk like the UN boys and say indigenous population remnants, or just bleakmen. What he had reference to was our licensing the mines owned by our settlement to use bleakmen at below scale, I mean below the minimum wage. Because even those fairies at the UN don't seriously propose we pay scale to bleakman niggers. However, we have this problem that we can't pay any minimum wage to the bleakman niggers because their work is so inconsistent that we go broke, and we have to use them in mining operations because they're the only ones who can breathe down there, and we can't get oxygen equipment in quantity transported over here at any price less than outrageous. Somebody's making a lot of money back home on those oxygen tanks and compressors and all that. It's a racket. And we're not going to get gouged, I can tell you." Everybody nodded somberly. "Now, we can't allow the UN bureaucrats to dictate to us how we'll run our settlement," Arnie said. "We set up operations here before the UN was anything here but a flag planted in the sand. We had houses built before they had a pot to piss in anywhere on Mars, including all that disputed area in the south between the US and France."
"Right, Arnie," the boys all agreed.
"However," Arnie said, "there's the problem that those UN fruits control the waterways, and we gotta have water. We need them for conveyance into and out of the settlement and for source of power and to drink and, like now, like we're here bathing. I mean, those buggers can cut off our water any time.
They got us by the short hairs.
He finished his shower and padded across the warm, wet tiles to get a towel from the attendant. Thinking about the UN made his stomach rumble, and his one-time duodenal ulcer began to burn way down in his left side, almost at the groin. Better get some breakfast, he realized. When he had been dressed by the attendant in his gray flannel trousers and T-shirt, soft leather boots, and nautical cap, he left the steam bath and crossed the corridor of the Union Hall to his dining room, where Helio, his Bleakman cook, had his breakfast waiting. Shortly, he sat before a stack of hotcakes and bacon, coffee, and a glass of orange juice, and the previous week's New York Times, the Sunday edition.
"Good morning, Mr. Cott."
In answer to his button pressing, a secretary from the pool had appeared, a girl he had never seen before. Not too good-looking, he decided after a brief glance. He returned to reading the newspaper. And calling him Mr. Cott, too. He sipped his orange juice and read about a ship that had perished in space with all 300 aboard killed. It was a Japanese merchantman carrying bicycles. That made him laugh. Bicycles in space, and all gone now. Too bad, because on a planet with little mass like Mars, where there was virtually no power source, except the sluggish canal system, and where even kerosene cost a fortune, bicycles were of great economic value. A man could pedal free of cost for hundreds of miles right over the sand, too. The only people who used kerosene-powered turbine conveyances were vital functionaries, such as the repair and maintenance men, and of course important officials, such as himself. There were public transports, of course, such as the tractor buses which connected one settlement with the next and the outlying residential areas with the world at large. But they ran irregularly, being dependent on shipments from Earth for their fuel. And personally speaking, the buses gave him a sense of claustrophobia. They moved so slow. Reading the New York Times made him feel for a little while as if he were back home again, in South Pasadena. His family had subscribed to the West Coast edition of the Times, and as a boy he remembered bringing it in from the mailbox, in from the street lined with apricot trees, the warm, smoggy little street of neat one-story houses and parked cars and lawns tended from one weekend to the next without fail. It was the lawn, with all its equipment and medicines, that he missed most. The wheelbarrow of fertilizer, the new grass seed, the snippers, the poultry netting fence in the early spring, and always the sprinklers at work throughout the long summer, whenever the law allowed. Water shortage there, too. Once his Uncle Paul had been arrested for washing his car on a water ration day. Reading further in the paper, he came upon an article about a reception at the White House for a Mrs. Lisner, who, as an official of the birth control agency, had performed 8,000 therapeutic abortions and had thereby set an example for American womanhood. Kind of like a nurse, Arnie Cott decided. Noble occupation for females. He turned the page. There, in big type, was a quarter-page ad which he himself had helped compose, a glowing come-on to get people to emigrate. Arnie sat back in his chair, folded the paper, felt deep pride as he studied the ad. It looked good, he decided. It would surely attract people if they had any guts at all and a sincere desire for adventure, as the ad said. The ad listed all the skills in demand on Mars, and it was a long list, excluding only canary raiser and proctologist, if that. It pointed out how hard it was now for a person with only a master's degree to get a job on Earth, and how on Mars there were good-paying jobs for people with only BAs. That ought to get them, Arnie thought. He himself had emigrated, due to his having only a BA. Every door had been shut to him, and then he had come to Mars as nothing but a union plumber. And within a few short years, look at him. On Earth, a plumber with only a BA would be raking up dead locusts in Africa as part of a U.S. foreign aid work gang. In fact, his brother Phil was doing that right now. He had graduated from the University of California and had never had a chance to practice his profession, that of milk tester. In his class, over 100 milk testers had been graduated, and for what? There were no opportunities on Earth. You have to come to Mars, Arnie said to himself. We can use you here. Look at the pokey cows on those dairy ranches outside of town. They could use some testing. But the catch in the ad was simply that once on Mars, the emigrant was guaranteed nothing, not even the certainty of being able to give up and go home. Trips back were much more expensive due to the inadequate field facilities. Certainly, he was guaranteed nothing in the way of employment. The fault lay with the big powers back home, China and the U.S. and Russia and West Germany. Instead of properly backing the development of the planets, they had turned their attention to further exploration. Their time and brains and money were all committed to the
sidereal projects, such as that frigging flight to Centaurus, which had already wasted billions of dollars and man-hours. Arnie Kott could not see the sidereal projects for beans. Who wanted to take a 4-year trip to another solar system which maybe wasn't even there? And yet at the same time, Arnie feared a change in the attitude of the great terrestrial powers. Suppose one morning they woke up and took a new look at the colonies on Mars and Venus. Suppose they eyed the ramshackle developments there and decided something should be done about them. In other words, what became of Arnie Kott when the great powers came to their senses? It was a thought to ponder. However, the great powers showed no symptoms of rationality. Their obsessive competitiveness still governed them. Right this moment, they were locking horns 2 light-years away, to Arnie's relief. Reading further in the paper, he came across a brief article having to do with a women's organization in Bern, Switzerland, which had met to declare once more its anxiety about colonization. Colonial Safety Committee alarmed over conditions of Mars landing fields. The ladies, in a petition presented to the Colonial Department of the UN, had expressed once more their conviction that the fields on Mars at which ships from Earth landed were too remote from habitation and from the water system. Passengers, in some cases, had been required to trek over 100 miles of wasteland, and these included women and children and old people. The Colonial Safety Committee wanted the UN to pass a regulation compelling ships to land at fields within 25 miles of a major named canal. Do-gooders, Arnie Kott thought as he read the article. Probably not one of them has ever been off Earth. They just know what somebody wrote home in a letter, some aunt retiring to Mars on a pension, living on free UN land and naturally griping. And of course they also depended on their member-in-residence on Mars, a certain Mrs. Anne Esterhazy. She circulated a mimeographed newsletter to other public-spirited ladies throughout the settlements. Arnie received and read her newsletter, The Auditor Speaks Back, a title at which he gagged. He gagged, too, at the 1- and 2-line squibs inserted between longer articles. Pray for potable purification. Contact colony charismatic counselors and witness for water filtration we can be proud of. He could hardly make out the meaning of some of the Auditor Speaks Back articles. They were phrased in such special jargon. But evidently the newsletter had attracted an audience of devoted women who grimly took each item to heart and acted out the deeds asked of them. Right now they were undoubtedly complaining, along with the Colonial Safety Committee back on Earth, about the hazardous distances separating most of the landing fields on Mars from water sources and human habitation. They were doing their part in one of the many great fights, and in this particular case, Arnie Kott had managed to gain control of his nausea. For of the 20 or so landing fields on Mars, only one lay within 25 miles of a major canal, and that was Samuel Gomper's field, which served his own settlement. If by some chance the pressure of the Colonial Safety Committee was effective, then all incoming passenger ships from Earth would have to land at Arnie Kott's field, with the revenue received going to his settlement. It was far from accidental that Mrs. Esterhazy and her newsletter and organization on Earth were advocating a cause which would be of economic value to Arnie. Anne Esterhazy was Arnie's ex-wife. They were still good friends, and still owned jointly a number of economic ventures which they had founded or bought into during their marriage. On a number of levels, they still worked together, even though on a strictly personal basis they had no common ground whatsoever. He found her aggressive, domineering, overly masculine, a tall and bony female with a long stride, wearing low-heeled shoes and a tweed coat and dark glasses, a huge leather purse slung from a strap over her shoulder. But she was shrewd and intelligent and a natural executive. As long as he did not have to see her outside of the business context, he could get along with her. The fact that Anne Esterhazy had once been his wife and that they still had financial ties was not well known. When he wanted to get in touch with her, he did not dictate a letter to one of the settlement's stenographers. Instead, he used a little encoding dictation machine which he kept in his desk, sending the reel of tape over to her by special messenger. The messenger dropped off the tape at an art object shop which Anne owned over in the Israeli settlement, and her answer, if any, was deposited the same way at the office of a cement and gravel works on the Bernard Baruch Canal, which belonged to Arnie's brother-in-law, Ed Rockingham, his sister's husband. A year ago, when Ed Rockingham had built a house for himself and Patricia and their 3 children, he had acquired the unacquirable, his own canal. He had had it built in open violation of the law for his private use, and it drew water from the Great Common Network. Even Arnie had been outraged, but there had been no prosecution. And today the canal, modestly named after Rockingham's eldest child, carried water 80 miles out into the desert so that Pat Rockingham could live in a lovely spot and have a lawn, a swimming pool, and a fully irrigated flower garden. She grew especially large camellia bushes, which were the only ones that had survived the transplanting to Mars. All during the day, sprinklers revolved and sprayed her bushes, keeping them from drying up and dying. 12 huge camellia bushes seemed to Arnicott an ostentation. He did not get along well with his sister or Ed Rockingham. What had they come to Mars for? He asked himself. To live at incredible expense and effort as much as possible as they had back home on Earth. To him, it was absurd. Why not remain on Earth? Mars, for Arnie, was a new place, and it meant a new life, lived with a new style. He and the other settlers, both big and small, had made in their time on Mars countless minute adjustments in a process of adaptation through so many stages that they had in fact evolved. They were new creatures now. Their children born on Mars started out like this, novel and peculiar, in some respects enigmatic to their parents. Two of his own boys, his and Anne's, now lived in a settlement camp at the outskirts of Lewistown. When he visited them, he could not make them out. They looked toward him with bleak eyes, as if waiting for him to go away. As near as he could tell, the boys had no sense of humor. And yet they were sensitive. They could talk forever about animals and plants, the landscape itself. Both boys had pets, Martian critters that struck him as horrid. Praying mantis types of bugs as large as donkeys. The damn things were called boxers because they were often seen propped up erect and squaring off at one another in a ritual battle which generally ended up with one killing and eating the other. Bert and Ned had gotten their pet boxers trained to do manual chores of a low caliber and not to eat each other. And the things were their companions. Children on Mars were lonely, partly because there were still so few of them, and partly because Arnie did not know. The children had a large-eyed, haunted look, as if they were starved for something as yet invisible. They tended to become reclusive, if given half a chance, wandering off to poke about in the wastelands. What they brought back was worthless to themselves and to the settlements, a few bones or relics of the old nigger civilization, perhaps. When he flew by copter, Arnie always spotted some isolated children, one here and another there, toiling away out in the desert, scratching at the rock and sand as if trying vaguely to pry up the surface of Mars and get underneath. Unlocking the bottom drawer of his desk, Arnie got out the little battery-powered encoding dictation machine and set it up for use. Into it, he said, "Anne, I'd like to meet with you and talk. That committee has too many women on it, and it's going the wrong way. For example, the last ad in the Times worries me because..." He broke off, for the encoding machine had grown to a stop. He poked at it, and the reels turned slowly and then once more settled back into silence. "Thought it was fixed," Arnie thought angrily. "Can't those jerks fix nothing?" Maybe he would have to go to the black market and buy at an enormous price another. He winced at the thought. The not-too-good-looking secretary from the pool, who had been sitting quietly across from him waiting, now responded to his nod. She produced her pencil and pad and began as he dictated. "Usually," Arnicott said, "I can understand how hard it is to keep things running, what with no parts hardly, and the way the local weather affects metal and wiring. However, I'm fed up with asking for competent repair service on a vital item like my encoding machine. I just gotta have it, that's all. So if you guys can't keep it working, I'm going to disband you and withdraw your franchise to practice the craft of repairing within the settlement, and I'll rely on outside service for our maintenance." He nodded once more, and the girl ceased writing.
"Shall I take the encoder over to the repair department, Mr. Cott?" she asked. "I'd be happy to, sir."
"No," Arnie grumbled. "Just run along." As she departed, Arnie once more picked up his New York Times and again read. Back home on Earth, he could buy a new encoder for almost nothing. In fact, back home, you could... Hell, look at the stuff being advertised. From old Roman coins to fur coats to camping equipment to diamonds to rocket ships to crabgrass poison. Jeez. However, his immediate problem was how to contact his ex-wife without the use of his encoder. "Maybe I can just drop by and see her," Arnie said to himself. Good excuse to get out of the office. He picked up the telephone and called for a copter to be made ready up above him on the roof of the Union Hall, and then he finished off the remains of his breakfast, wiped his mouth hurriedly, and set off for the elevator. "Hi, Arnie," the copter pilot greeted him, a pleasant-faced young man from the pilot pool. "Hi, my boy," Arnie said, as the pilot assisted him into the special leather seat which he had had made at the settlement's fabric and upholstery shop. As the pilot got into the seat ahead of him, Arnie leaned back comfortably, crossed his legs, and said, "Now you just take off and I'll direct you in flight. And take it easy, because I'm in no hurry. It looks like a nice day."
"Real nice day," the pilot said, as the blades of the copter began to rotate. "Except for that haze over around the FDR range."
They had hardly gotten into the air when the copter's loudspeaker came on. "Emergency announcement. There is a small party of Bleakmen out on the open desert at gyro compass point 4.65003, dying from exposure and lack of water. Ships north of Lewistown are instructed to direct their flights to that point with all possible speed and give assistance. United Nations law requires all commercial and private ships to respond."
The announcement was repeated in the crisp voice of the UN announcer, speaking from the UN transmitter on the artificial satellite somewhere overhead.
Feeling the copter alter its course, Arnie said, "Aw, come on, my boy."
"I have to respond, sir," the pilot said. "It's the law."
"Christ's sake," Arnie thought with disgust. He made a mental note to have the boy sacked, or at least suspended, as soon as they got back from their trip. Now they were above the desert, moving at good speed toward the intersect which the UN announcer had given. "Bleakmen niggers," Arnie thought. "We have to drop everything we're doing to bail them out, the damn fools. Can't they trot across their own desert? Haven't they been doing it without our help for 5,000 years? As Jack Boland started to lower his Yee Company repair ship toward McAuliffe's dairy ranch below, he heard the UN announcer come on with the emergency notification, the like of which Boland had heard many times before and which never failed to chill him. "Party of Bleakmen out on the open desert," the matter-of-fact voice declared. "Dying from exposure and lack of water. Ships north of Lewistown."
"I've got it," Jack Boland said to himself. He cut his mic on and said, "Yee Company repair ship close by gyro compass point 4.65003, ready to respond at once. Should reach them in 2 or 3 minutes.
He swung his copter south, away from McAuliffe's ranch, getting a golden moment sort of satisfaction at the thought of McAuliffe's indignation right now as he saw the copter swing away and guessed the reason. No one had less use for the Bleakmen than did the big ranchers. The poverty-stricken nomadic natives were constantly showing up at the ranches for food, water, medical help, and sometimes just a plain old-fashioned handout. And nothing seemed to madden the prosperous dairymen more than to be used by the creatures whose land they had appropriated. Another copter was responding now. The pilot was saying, "I'm just outside Lewistown at gyro compass point 4.78995 and will respond as soon as possible. I have rations aboard, including 50 gallons of water."
He gave his identification and then rang off.
The dairy ranch with its cows fell away to the north, and Jack Boland was gazing intently down at the open desert once more, seeking to catch sight of the party of Bleakmen. Sure enough, there they were, 5 of them, in the shade cast by a small hill of stone. They were not moving. Possibly they were already dead. The UN satellite, in its swing across the sky, had discovered them, and yet it could not help them. Their mentors were powerless. "And we who can help them, what do we care?" Jack thought. The Bleakmen were dying out anyhow, the remnants getting more tattered and despairing every year. They were wards of the UN, protected by them. Some protection, Jack thought. But what could be done for a waning race? Time had run out for the natives of Mars long before the first Soviet ship had appeared in the sky with its television cameras grinding away back in the 60s. No human group had conspired to exterminate them. It had not been necessary. And anyhow, they had been a vast curiosity at first. Here was a discovery worth the billions spent in the task of reaching Mars. Here was an extraterrestrial race. He landed the copter on the flat sand close by the party of Bleakmen, switched off the blades, opened the door, and stepped out. The hot morning sun beat down on him as he walked across the sand toward the unmoving Bleakmen. They were alive. They had their eyes open and were watching him. "Rains are falling from me onto your valuable persons," he called to them, the proper Bleakmen greeting in the Bleaky dialect. Close to them now, he saw that the party consisted of one wrinkled old couple, a young male and female, no doubt husband and wife, and their infant. A family, obviously, which had set out across the desert alone on foot, probably seeking water or food. Perhaps the oasis at which they had been subsisting had dried up. It was typical of the plight of the Bleakmen, this conclusion to their trek. Here they lay, unable to go on any farther.
They had withered away to something resembling heaps of dried vegetable matter, and they would have died soon had not the UN satellite spotted them. Rising to his feet slowly, the young Bleakman male genuflected and said in a wavering, frail voice, "The rains falling from your wonderful presence and vigor and restore us, mister." Jack Boland tossed his canteen to the young Bleakman, who at once knelt down, unscrewed the cap, and gave it to the supine elderly couple. The old lady seized it and drank from it. The change in her came at once. She seemed to swell back into life, to change from the muddy gray color of death before his eyes.
"May we fill our eggshells?" the young Bleakman male asked Jack.
Lying upright on the sand were several paca eggs, pale, hollow shells which Jack saw were completely empty. The Bleakman transported water in these shells. Their technical ability was so slight that they did not even possess clay pots. And yet, he reflected, their ancestors had constructed the great canal system. "Sure," he said. "There's another ship coming with plenty of water." He went back to his copter and got his lunch pail. Returning with it, he handed it to the Bleakman male. "Food," he explained, as if they didn't know. Already the elderly couple were on their feet, tottering up with their hands stretched out. Behind Jack, the roar of a second copter grew louder. It was landing, a big two-person copter that now coasted up and halted, its blades slowly spinning. The pilot called down, "Do you need me? If not, I'll go on." "I don't have much water for them," Jack said. "Okay," the pilot said and switched off his blades. He hopped out, lugging a 5-gallon can. "They can have this." Together, Jack and the pilot stood watching the Bleakman filling their eggshells from the can of water. Their possessions were not many. A quiver of poisoned arrows, an animal hide for each of them. The two women had their pounding blocks, their sole possessions of value. Without the blocks, they were not fit women, for on them they prepared either meat or grain, whatever food their hunt might bring. And they had a few cigarettes. "My passenger," the young pilot said in a low voice in Jack's ear, "isn't too keen about the UN being able to compel us to stop like this. But what he doesn't realize is that they've got that satellite up there and they can see if we fail to stop, and it's a hell of a big fine." Jack turned and looked up into the parked copter. He saw seated inside it a heavy-set man with a bald head, a well-fed, self-satisfied-looking man who gazed out sourly, paying no attention to the 5 Bleakmen. "You have to comply with the law," the pilot said in a defensive voice. "It'd be me who they'd sock with the fine." Walking over to the ship, Jack called up to the big bald-headed man seated within. "Doesn't it make you feel good to know you saved the lives of 5 people?" The bald-headed man looked down at him and said, "5 niggers, you mean? I don't call that saving 5 people, do you?" "Yeah, I do," Jack said, "and I intend to continue doing so."
"Go ahead, call it that," the bald-headed man said.
Flushing, he glanced over at Jack's copter, read the markings on it.
"See where it gets you."
Coming over beside Jack, the young pilot said hurriedly, "That's Arnie you're talking to, Arnie Cott." He called up, "We can leave now, Arnie." Climbing up, the pilot disappeared inside the copter, and once more the blades began to turn. The copter rose into the air, leaving Jack standing alone by the 5 Bleakmen. They had now finished drinking and were eating from the lunch pail which he had given them. The empty water can lay off to one side. The paca eggshells had been filled and were now stoppered. The Bleakmen did not glance up as the copter left. They paid no attention to Jack, either. They murmured among themselves in their dialect. "What's your destination?" Jack asked them. The young Bleakman named an oasis very far to the south. "You think you can make it?" Jack asked. He pointed to the old couple. "Can they?"
"Yes, mister," the young Bleakman answered. "We can make it now with the food and water yourself and the other mister gave us."
"I wonder if they can," Jack said to himself. Naturally, they'd say it, even if they knew it wasn't possible. Racial pride, I guess.
"Mister," the young Bleakman said, "we have a present for you because you stopped."
He held out something to Jack. Their possessions were so meager that he could not believe they had anything to spare. He held his hand out, however, and the young Bleakman put something small and cold into it, a dark, wrinkled, dried bit of substance that looked to Jack like a section of tree root.
"It is a water witch," the Bleakman said. "Mister, it will bring you water, the source of life, any time you need."
"It didn't help you, did it?" Jack said.
With a sly smile, the young Bleakman said,
"Mister, it helped. It brought you."
"What'll you do without it?" Jack asked.
"We have another, mister. We fashion water witches."
The young Bleakman pointed to the old couple.
"They are authorities."
More carefully examining the water witch, Jack saw that it had a face and vague limbs. It was mummified, once a living creature of some sort. He made out its drawn-up legs, its ears. He shivered. The face was oddly human, a wizened, suffering face, as if it had been killed while crying out. "How does it work?" he asked the young Bleakman.
"Formerly, when one wanted water, one pissed on the water witch and she came to life. Now we do not do that, mister. We have learned from you, mistress, that to piss is wrong. So we spit on her instead, and she hears that too almost as well. It wakes her, and she opens and looks around, and then she opens her mouth and calls the water to her, as she did with you, mister, and that other mister, the big one who sat and did not come down, the mister with no hair on his head."
"That mister is a powerful mister," Jack said. "He's a monarch of the Plumbers Union settlement, and he owns all of Lewistown."
"That may be," the young Bleakman said. "If so, we will not stop at Lewistown, because we could see that the mister with no hair did not like us. We did not give him a water witch in return for his water, because he did not want to give us water. His heart was not with him in that deed. It came from his hands only."
Jack said goodbye to the Bleakman and got back into his copter. A moment later, he was ascending. Below him, the Bleakman waved solemnly. "I'll give the water witch to David," he decided, "when I get home at the end of the week. He can piss on it or spit on it, whichever he prefers, to his heart's content."